Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Robert Hockett. Robert teaches financial and business law subjects at Cornell Law School, where his research and writing focus on the legal and institutional prerequisites to a just and prosperous economic order. He is also a fellow at the Century Foundation, a commissioned author for the New America Foundation, and consultant to a number of financial institutions, regulators, and legislators. Prior to entering legal academia, he worked at the International Monetary Fund and served as a judicial clerk for the Honorable Donnell Reese Tacha, Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit. He was educated at the University of Kansas, Oxford University, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar, and Yale University. Robert also authored a memorandum entitled It Takes a Village, Municipal Condemnation Proceedings and Public-Private Partnerships for Mortgage Loan Modification, Value Preservation, and Economic Recovery. And it's that memorandum that we'll be speaking with him today. Robert, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks so much, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
You betcha. How did the idea for the research paper come about? Was this just an idea that you had, or did somebody want you to write something for that cause?
Yeah, it's a bit of both in a way. The basic idea goes back a good long way, basically to the sort of emergence of the crisis itself, right? So once the mortgage markets sort of peaked and then plunged back in 2006, a good many academics, not surprisingly, as well as other sort of policy wonk types and interested professionals and you name it, just concerned citizens, became quite interested in sort of what we might do about what looked likely to turn into a significant national real estate crisis that would have fallout effects or knock-on effects that would ultimately culminate in a financial crisis as well. When that financial crisis itself began to emerge or to sort of become conspicuous, let's say, around the summer of 2008, some of us academics in particular became concerned with how might we best put a bottom under or a floor under still plummeting real estate prices? How might we sort of stabilize real estate markets and thereby stabilize the broader financial system? So a few of us began, I can speak for myself in this case, I began suggesting that, look, what we've really got to do is somehow manage to concentrate holdings of some of the mortgage loans, in particular the underwater mortgage loans themselves, with a view ultimately to preserving value, because my claim was that there was something kind of like a bank run underway. That's to say, a lot of the so-called toxic assets were being valued by the market at even less than their sustainable value was, right? I mean, they were indeed toxic, meaning that their real value was less than what their bubble values had been, but that nevertheless the bust value was even lower than the then current market value, what should be the then current market value. And so the claim was that you've essentially got to assemble large blocks of these things to sort of address the problem. I think once the TARP monies became available, I was suggesting that they ought to be used to do that, that if you basically fix the mortgage loan problem with TARP monies, you'll thereby fix or sort of stabilize the then destabilizing financial markets. Some people agreed with that, others didn't. And then I argued at the time that, you know, in trying to amass those large holdings of mortgage loans, any government instrumentality that found some people were sort of unwilling to sell, basically in exercising holdup power to try to extract a higher price from government authorities that would be buying them up, should use eminent domain. So I kind of went from there to saying various federal instrumentalities, either FHA or maybe more to the point, the GSEs, should use eminent domain if necessary. Around the same time, a couple of other academics, maybe either around that time or shortly thereafter, a couple of other academics began suggesting use of eminent domain as a kind of a first resort rather than a last resort. So I was arguing that it should be used as a last resort. I didn't actually think it would likely be necessary because I thought that given the way way in which the market was undervaluing the assets at the time, they could probably be purchased at a decent price by federal instrumentalities anyway. But again, in the event of holdouts from some people, I argued that eminent domain could be used. And then these other academics were sort of suggesting that eminent domain should be used as a first resort. All of us at first were, the three of us who were talking about this, I guess, at first, were talking in terms of federal instrumentalities using this authority. As things progressed, as things kind of continued, and it began to look less and less likely that the federal instrumentalities would do anything like this, some began talking about the possibility of using state instrumentalities or municipalities. And so state and municipal use of eminent domain as a fallback option got onto the table pretty kind of late-ish 2008 or 2009. And then those of us who had proposed these things kind of kept talking about them now and again in various articles and pieces that we wrote. And then eventually, about a year or so ago, an old classmate of mine from Oxford days, who was the who founded this entity known as Mortgage Resolution Partners, began thinking about maybe trying actually to pursue the municipal version of the eminent domain idea. And to sort of make things even more interesting, he retained the services of another friend of mine, an investment banker, but neither of them knew that I knew the other one. But he retained the services of another friend of mine, an investment banker, to sort of help put together a plan that would work financially. And then they asked me, both of them approached me about kind of early this year to sort of assist with the sort of thinking it through legally, maybe partly because they knew that I had written in this area for a number of years and partly because they knew me and were old friends of mine.
Okay.
So that's essentially how I, you know, got involved with MRP in particular.
Yeah, with the report pretty much is entirely done early in 2012.
Yeah, the report itself is essentially the product of lots of work that I had done in the months and even years preceding
okay.
The sort of the MRP approach to San Bernardino and others. The one exception is that some of the specific legal analysis that you find in Part 4 or Section 4 of that particular memorandum. I did specifically in response to MRP's questions. Basically because MRP said, look, we're interested in California to begin with, and that was why. So you might have noticed if you happen to have a chance to read through that long memorandum, it's, I guess,
15
pages.
I read it twice with a yellow marker.
Well, very kind of you. So the Section 4 talks about it, provides a legal analysis, and you might have noted that part of the analysis is federal in character, and then part of the analysis is state law in character. And the state law analysis is Californian. The focus on California is a direct product of MRP's having asked me to kind of help think through the legalities of launching an eminent domain program of the sort that I had talked about in years past in California in particular.
Any recent trends in the marketplace that would have you change anything in the report?
Not that I can think of, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
I mean, of course, there have been some recent reports of yet again, right, that, oh, maybe we've reached the bottom in the mortgage markets, you know, maybe there aren't as many foreclosures down the pike or whatever. But that seems to happen every few months, and we always end up in the same place, right? And so, you know, nothing really significant seems to have changed since I wrote that up.
Okay. I'd like to cover the constitutional basis first, just because
sure.
I just want to make sure an audience understands kind of the gist of it. And so this is a quote. The gist of preeminent domain is that any sovereign authority, so long as it acts and in the name of the people, holds dominion over property within its jurisdiction that is implicitly prior to that of any particular individual. In simple English, that means if you own a property that gets in the way of a greater public service, purpose, the government has the ability to take it from you and pay you for it. Is that sort of the short version of it?
That's a sort of a short playing version. It's a kind of a residual authority that any government has to engage in or to sort of cause to occur what our English forebears used to call a compulsory sale. In the interest of the broader public, right?
So, what are the conditions that must be present for that to occur?
There are basically just two. The first is that there has to be an actual public purpose, right? It can't be simply to benefit one private party at the expense of another, right? That would be unjust, and that would be inimical to the basic values that underpin our constitutional order. So there has to be an actual public purpose, and it has to be, you know, a bona fide, real public purpose, not a merely pretextual one. That's the first condition that has to be met. And then, of course, the second one is that fair value has to be actually paid, right? You can't just sort of say, well, you know, and fair value that's taken quite seriously by the courts. So, for example, let's say that the government announces that it's going to take a certain form of property, and let's say that the prices of that form of property go down because the government has made this announcement. And so then the prices go down after the government makes that announcement, and then the government announces it's going to pay those lower prices that, you know, have been arrived at.
The new comp, yeah.
Right. That wouldn't be fair value.
Okay.
Right? That would be a very sort of transparent case of unfair value. And so for that reason, of course, our constitutional order and the eminent domain authority that we have under our constitutional authority has always been understood to exclude that kind of chicanery, right? Essentially, it has to be fair value. What that means in turn is if there are actual markets out there for equivalent kinds of property, those actual markets' prices are relevant, you know, in determining what fair value is. In the absence of such markets, then one has to use, any government authority has to use plausible valuation methods. And there are all sorts of, you know, very orthodox, familiar, widely accepted methods or methodologies of valuation that are the subject of lots of business school textbooks, right? So there's, of course, the discounted cash flow method, which is probably the most familiar, but there are various other valuation methods, almost all of which are known in turn being, kind of quite widely accepted. Obscure valuation methods that aren't widely accepted, that are highly unorthodox, typically wouldn't pass court muster or constitutional muster.
Many of us would be aware that, let's say, of an eminent domain, Riverside County, San Bernardino County, lots of population, expansion of freeways. And so we've seen some of those houses close to the freeway occasionally disappear.
Sure.
And we understand that's a purpose of eminent domain. But I don't think very many of us were aware that it could apply to something like ownership of a loan. So
right.
What is the precedent for that?
Yeah, so a couple things to say about that. The first is that, yeah, many non-lawyers tend to associate exercises of eminent domain authority in their minds with compulsory sales of real estate, right, of houses or strips of land or what have you. And I think there's a very good reason for that. The reason that we tend, in almost sort of Pavlovian fashion, to associate eminent domain with that kind of compulsory sale is because that kind of compulsory sale is typically much more conspicuous, right? For one thing, of course, you see that house when you drive by it on the highway, and then you notice that it's gone. Sort of relatedly, I think a lot of us develop kind of territorial attachments to our real estate in particular, right? Your home is your castle, and it's something that you develop a very close psychological association with, in the same way that, you know, all sorts of non-human animals developed territorial imperatives about the areas in which they hunt and so forth. And so we tend to be, you know, especially kind of surprised by compulsory sales of that kind, or so-called takings of that kind. And I suppose that's those two reasons then, you know, the sort of conspicuousness on the one hand and the sort of invocation of our sort of territorial tendencies on the other hand are probably the two principal reasons that we're much more apt to notice exercises of eminent domain over that kind of property. Nevertheless, any lawyer, as distinguished from any layperson who knows a bit about property law or who knows a bit about eminent domain authority or local government law or land use law or what have you, will be able to tell you that eminent domain authority applies to all forms of property. So as new forms of property come into existence, you know, over the decades and over the centuries, new forms of property that are subject, in theory at least, to eminent domain authority also coming into existence, right? So say, you know, 100 years ago, there probably was nothing that would be called intellectual property, right? Nowadays, of course, intellectual property is among the most important kinds of property. And, of course, intellectual property can be subject to eminent domain authority. The broader category under which intellectual property fits is the category of so-called intangibles or intangible property. And it's long been understood and appreciated that eminent domain authority extends to intangible property. Again, it's extended to those forms of property for as long as they have existed. That's the first part of the answer, I guess. The second part of the answer is, okay, well, what about precedent? Well, there's just all sorts of precedent, and I can just, you know, mention a few particular examples, for example. So eminent domain authority in recent decades and over the past century, say, more in a more extended sense, has been exercised in relation to railroad stocks, in relation to various forms of debt, in relation to sports franchises, notably the Oakland Raiders out there in your state, which of course is the franchise, not the team, or not the team players or the jerseys or the shoulder pads or whatever. What are some other examples?
That's okay. No, I think we got
you get the basic idea.
Okay. The eminent domain powers of one of the public services it provides is to prevent blight.
Yes.
And in looking at that, you know, I look at blight and I see Riverside's type of blight or San Bernardino's type of blight, and then I look at Detroit. So there's all different kind of levels of blight, and I guess I wanted to know who would determine that the level of blight has reached a serious proportion. But also in your document, it said something interesting. It wasn't only for the reversal, but the prevention of likely blight.
Right.
And
right.
That was a little that was a new one.
Yeah, right. So, I guess there are maybe a couple things to say about that, right? So the first point is that various municipalities, as long as they have democratic governments, right, democratic local governments, are recognized by the courts as having a fairly wide range of legitimate discretion in determining, right, what counts as blight. That's not to say that there are no limits. It's just to say that there is a fair degree of discretion that all counties, or and indeed all democratic democratically legislatively governed units of government, be they municipalities or states or whatever, or the federal government for that matter, are recognized by the courts as having when it comes to determining public purpose more broadly and blight more narrowly. Second thing to point out is essentially to go back to that idea that I noted a moment ago, which is that there are nevertheless limits, right? There's a range of discretion, but it's not an infinite range. So the question then becomes, well, what are the limits, right? What cabins the range? Well, the answer to that is, of course, court decisions that interpret constitutional provisions that apply to the governments in question. So if you're talking about a municipality, of course, that means that the state constitution is one provides, interpreted by the courts, provides one limit. And then, of course, the federal constitution, as interpreted by the courts, provides another limit. Typically, those two sets of limits coincide, but in theory, they could diverge. And when they diverge, of course, it's the federal constitution that trumps. Next question, then, is, all right, well, what are those constitutional limits? And this will get us to the idea of prevention of blight or the sort of more speculative determinations as to, you know, whether something is going to end up yielding a public benefit or not. The outer limits of the authority have, of course, most recently been determined by the U.S. Supreme Court in the famous, or in many people's estimation, infamous Kelo decision, right, from 2005. So This was a decision, and forgive me if I'm, you know, saying more than you need to know, or, you know, a lot of stuff that you already know, but I'll try to be cursory about it. Essentially, the City of New London, Connecticut, determined that there was a significant likelihood of some degree of economic revitalization that the City of New London would enjoy if the city were to confiscate at fair value homes that were lived in by predominantly elderly and lower middle income Connecticutans, and then to convey that property that it would pay fair value for it, and then to convey that property to the Pfizer Corporation to create a pharmaceutical development of some or pharmaceutical facility of some sort. And this was viewed by many as controversial for a couple of reasons. For one thing, the putative public purpose, namely, you know, economic revitalization or an economic boost of some sort, was viewed by many as a very speculative claim by the City of New London, right? I mean, it was not a definite, you know, you couldn't say with certainty that there's going to be a substantial boost in economic activity just by dint of conveying these private properties over to the private firm known as Pfizer. And then, of course, the second reason for the controversy was that, indeed, there was a conveyance to this private firm known as Pfizer. In other words, a conveyance of a private property from one party to another party was a means of attaining that putative end, that putatively public end, known as economic revitalization. And notwithstanding both of those difficulties, right, both of those kind of grounds for controversy, the speculative nature of the economic benefit to the community on the one hand, and the fact that a means toward that end was the conveyance of property from one private party to another on the other hand, notwithstanding both of those difficulties, as we all know, the Supreme Court, rather infamously, upheld that particular exercise of the eminent domain authority by the City of New London, Connecticut. Now, what's interesting about that, of course, for present purposes is, I guess, two things, right? One is it does suggest that the limits on exercises of the eminent domain authority, at least as far as the Constitution is concerned, are fairly broad. Again, they're not infinite, but they're broader than maybe some people had thought in 2005, and certainly broader than a lot of people think that they ought to be, including myself. But then the second thing that's interesting is I find it very instructive to kind of contrast the situation that you find in the Kelo case on the one hand with what you find in San Bernardino on the other. And indeed, I think of San Bernardino's possible use of eminent domain right now as constituting a kind of inverse Kelo. It's almost the opposite of Kelo in particularly important respects. One, of course, is that San Bernardino is contemplating use of this authority to keep people in their homes, right, not to sort of boot people from their homes. And then two is the fact that you actually have a really good, not merely speculative, but quite determinate case to be made here that blight will indeed be being reversed and or prevented. And the reason for that is, you know, many-fold, but, you know, among the reasons are that, first of all, of course, if you have mass homelessness suddenly taking place owing to mass foreclosures in a particular county, that's, of course, going to create all sorts of sort of local dysfunction in its own right. Well, it's also, of course, going to mean property values take a huge hit, and then that means the city loses its revenue base, and that means, of course, city services are retracted or the city goes bankrupt, which, of course, it already has at this point. And that means, of course, that even people who are current on their loans or who don't owe anything on their houses will lose value in their homes as well, and many of them will be tempted to leave, and that will just add more property to the current glut, which will drive prices down even further, and then you get the classic vicious spiral downward.
Well, all of what you just said, I mean, actually happened in 2008.
Yes. The beginnings of it.
We only have two more minutes in this segment. So.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the beginnings. Of course, this process began in 2008, and in some ways, it began even sooner. But it's not finished, right? And a lot of the numbers that I guess I lay out in the beginning of the big white paper that you mentioned, the memorandum, sort of bring that out, right? I mean, half of loans, right? Half of the mortgage loans in San Bernardino right now are underwater, but haven't already defaulted. But, you know, as we know, underwater mortgage loans are very, very likely eventually to go delinquent and default, and that means San Bernardino can look forward to even more, right, delinquencies, defaults, foreclosures, property value hits, revenue base hits, service retractions, more people, mass exodus. San Bernardino, which now has, I guess, the second highest poverty rate in the nation after Detroit, might end up surpassing Detroit where that's concerned if things continue as they currently are going.
Well, that's one of the reasons why, and we're inside of a minute now, is in our next segment, we'll talk specifically about some of the things that are going on in the current marketplace, because there's a lot of demand for the housing product. And one of the things that's happened is it has been a slowdown in foreclosures. Mm-hmm. And you had a lot of people foreclosed on in 2008 and 2009 who are now reemerging as buyers. and creating a lot of demand for the product. When we just we got 20 seconds left. When we go to the next segment, I want to just touch briefly on a Hawaii court case that you mentioned, MidKef.
Oh, the MidKef case.
Yeah, I find that interesting as far as its intention and its final result. All right, we've ended our first segment with Robert Hockett, and he'll be joining us again for the next segment. Thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.